check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I'm your host, Barrymore. At the age of 8, my next guest started racing junior dragsters and had a great career debut, winning 4 out of 5 races. In 2018, with a bike built by the team themselves, she became the first female in the world to cross a 200-mile-per-hour barrier on a street-tire drag bike with a whopping 202.5 miles per hour. In 2020, she finally broke the 7-second barrier, clocking an impressive 6.98 seconds, or 331 kilometers an hour, 205.9 miles per hour. Now she has a personal best of 6.88 seconds, or 346 kilometers an hour, or 214.9 miles per hour. Coming up next, this is Ida Zetterstrom. Well, welcome, Ida. You're part of a pretty prestigious group, hey? Like, not very many people break the 200-mile-an-hour barrier on two wheels.
I guess so. And at least for us women, we are not that many, so.
No, it's incredible. Like, today it's just been women on bikes. I don't know what the heck. Just how it started to come together. But all of you have a different story. And locally, there's very few of you in each of your groups. Like, there needs to be a woman's a world league where you can all just sort of hash it out and see who the best is.
That would be really cool.
Yeah,
we are usually divided, you know, in so many different classes. There are women racing, but usually we are not that many in each class.
Yeah,
you know,
fair.
Like the pro stock bike girls, they are a few in US, and they're actually quite a few of them.
Yeah,
but over here, it's not as many.
And do you guys have a lot of facilities? Like, what's the limiting factor? Like, what's the barrier to keep women out of the motorsport?
Like for me or locally, as I see it here, we don't have any place to train. I don't have a track locally where I live. I have to go to Sweden. I live in Finland now. Yeah. Or if I go to Finland, it's actually like 12-hour ride just to get there. So it's how do you say, like, the you have to cross quite a big bridge to get there. So you have to, you know, really, really be passionate about it. It's hard to be like, yeah, we'll try this because it's fun. Because since it's so limited, our seasons are short, everything is very expensive. I think it's kind of hard to get people in it that haven't tried it, not just women, but
anybody really. Yeah.
Also, yeah, exactly. We have talked about, you know, the younger generation. We're actually trying to get a local drag strip set up here, just like 100 meters or so, just something short, so that the kids could try the uni dragsters or the uni drag bikes, maybe license over here, so that they are actually licensed when they go to a big event. Because right now, you know, it's a huge deal to go to an event with 30,000 spectators on the grandstands the first time you're actually trying this out. You don't even know if it's for you.
Yeah.
So I really want to work for that over here, you know, just trying to get women and younger generation just into the sports.
That's crazy. And you started at a pretty young age. Like, you're an old hand at this. You've been around for some time, right? Like,
yeah, I did. I think I licensed when I was 7. It was actually, I think you can start when you were 8, but I was turning 8, so I could take my license then and start. Yeah. I started racing for real when I was 8. But I've been at the track since I was 3 weeks old, so I'm as grown up to in it as you can be. So.
Yeah, it's in your blood. Like, yeah. So that must have been a huge help, being part of a racing family, a legacy. Like, your family's already at the track, so it's easy for you to...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And what do your parents think? Like, you're in one of the most dangerous sports that there is. Do they watch your races, or?
Yeah, I don't think they watch the races. They are with us the whole time. My crew is, my dad is one of my crew guys, and my dad is actually, he is, you know, one of the biggest parts of our crew. And he helps me with everything from the build up to just being the connecting link at the races and everything. And my mom usually comes along just to cook, help us with media, just get everything ready. So it's a whole family deal.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. And do you even remember your first race?
I did, yeah, because we actually lived in Sweden then, but yep. I have been at this small island when I can just explain it. I'm born in Sweden, yep. In Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. I now live in Åland Islands, which is a small island located between Sweden and Finland.
Okay, yeah.
It actually belongs to Finland. So I moved to Finland, but we do speak Swedish. So for me, it's more like a Swedish island, a Swedish part of Finland.
Yeah.
But I've been here. When I grew up, we were here all summers. We were here during, you know, Christmas and everything like that. My grandmother is from here. My mother is from here. My grandmother lives here. So this was actually when I raced for the first time. They had a local, you know, not a drag race, just like a street race,
yep.
A small street race, a two-day event. And my dad had built me a junior dragster, and they allowed me to test it for the first time here since
That's
I was
sweet.
Still a bit young to...
Yeah,
get
yeah.
The license for reals.
That's awesome. And the bike you ride today, what kind of bike is that?
It's a Hayabusa.
Yeah.
Turbocharged Hayabusa.
Yeah.
So it's we have about 750 horsepower.
My God.
In the Hayabusa. So it's for a street tire bike without wheelie bars, it's quite a lot of horsepower to put down.
Yeah, man. I love looking at your bike. Like, it's just so sick.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. Like, it's so long. Like, you had to extend the rear in order to keep from the wheelie. Yeah,
it's extended. Yeah, so here in Europe we can run it 68 inches as the most.
Okay,
so that's what we are running, and all of the guys in this class are running. I know some people over here, the class is called Super Street Bike.
Yep.
And many people compare it to Pro Street Bike, which they run in US.
Yeah,
the bikes are quite similar, but the class is run on different rule books, so it's quite a big difference. They run a lot faster in US. A lot of it is because of the different rules. They
yep.
can be a lot longer, and they also have how do you say, like a weight to length ratio. So I'm, as a light driver, I can be shorter, which when you have a heavy rider, you can be longer.
Okay.
But then also the tracks over there are just very,
yeah.
How do you say it? They are just, they're better, and they run there all the time. We have like one or two events a year at one track. The track don't get as good then as it does over there when they run it every other weekend or so.
Yeah.
But yeah, the bikes are long, but they're not as long as they are in US. For US Pro Street, you have a short bike if you run 68 inches, but
okay.
For us, we all run the same.
And what do you do for fuel? Like, you don't use pump gas, I imagine. You guys have to use race fuel?
No, we have a few options. You can run C85 ethanol.
Okay.
You can run MS109. You can run methanol. That was new for last season, that you can run methanol.
Okay.
Or actually 2019, it was first season you can run methanol. Earlier, they run leaded fuel, which most of the guys run in US
yeah.
now, but over here in Europe, you can't run leaded fuel. It's illegal.
Yeah.
So when they took away the leaded fuel, then they had to give other options. And then methanol was one of the options you could.
Yeah. Leaded fuel gives a lot of power, and it smells so nice.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
yeah.
I know, but we can't run it.
Yeah.
So when I bought the bike that we have now, I bought it from US, raced it there one event, and then we took it home. We totally took it down to pieces, just onto the frame,
yeah.
And we built everything for me as a rider, as how I'm positioned on the bike, how I like to ride it, but also according to our rules. And also we wanted to use the same engine setup that we had used before. And then we also changed fuel.
Your bike number is 13, hey? Like, how did you come to get that number?
Yeah. Actually, the bike was called Lucky 13 when I bought it.
Okay.
So when I bought it, the bike was called Lucky. So it said Lucky on the back. It was green and white. And it has kind of been an icon in US, like Super Street or Pro Street Bike Racing. And I kind of didn't want to take that away. I know that NEM, as a the guy I bought the bike from, it was his baby. He had built that bike and it was just, you know, it was his bike.
Yeah,
everybody
for sure.
knew about the Lucky 13. I still wanted to make it my own. I wanted to have my team colors and everything, but I just couldn't take away the name. So we still have the Four Clover 13 yeah. on the side, and we still call her Lucky. It's still Lucky, but it's kind of Lucky 2.0.
That's awesome.
And I actually had to ask them if I could run number 13 because you can't enter for number 13. It's, you know,
it's banned.
It's a number. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I called one of the guys that worked with it and said, I kind of want to run 13. I know it sounds strange, but I want to run 13. You know, the bike is Lucky 13. And he said, yeah, okay, we open it up for you. You can run 13. And
that's
we ended
crazy.
Up winning the series that year. So
it
has to have been Lucky 13.
Well, I mean, luck plays a huge role, but everything else is you.
Yeah, we usually say that, like, I love the bike. It's called Lucky and everything, but I don't really believe in luck. I believe in
you make it.
Hard work and dedication, and we make our own luck. That's just how we do it.
You get this bike off somebody from America who clearly loves this bike. How does that come to be? Like, how do you...
The thing was, we had built the first Super Street bike I ran. We had built totally from the ground up ourselves, and we had done that with two bikes. The thing for us is our seasons are so short.
Yeah.
We have very limited schedule, and every year we were changing stuff. And you don't want to change everything at once because then you don't really have any idea what worked and what didn't. So we changed small stuff all the time. But it just felt like we were running out of seasons. So we were standing in the decision either to maybe take a year off and totally rebuild the bike because we didn't have time to
do both,
make all those big upgrades. And I also calculated like the numbers, how it'd be to make all these upgrades. I saw this bike coming up for sale, and we had been in US watching this Man Cup race the year before. And we saw this bike run, and we actually met the rider of the bike on the night. Nemis was the owner of the bike, but then we had a guy, Mike Kovacevic, that rode the bike, and we met him in Clearwater Beach at the after party.
Yeah.
Started talking, became friends, and he was a great guy. So when the bike came up for sale, I checked it out. I kind of calculated it against our numbers. I was, you know, building everything from scratch, buying a bike that has good parts on it that we would have had to buy anyway. And I just called Mike up and I was like, do you think Lucky is a bike for me? Do you think it would be good? And he just said, yeah, it's one of the best bikes I've ever ridden. It's a bike that goes straight. It's a fun bike and it's definitely a good choice. And the price was decent also. So we just started talking to the owner and see if we could set it up. I actually had planned to race in Valdosta that year on the Man Cup finals, but on a rented bike.
Yeah.
But since this bike came up, we thought then we can run it there before we take it home. So it kind of, I kind of saved some money from not having to rent a bike also. So it kind of all just came together. So.
It sounds like it was meant to be. 2018, that's the year you broke 200 miles an hour. Like, how fast did you get?
So 2018, we were just above, just above 200. I think we were 201 or 201.5.
Oh, wow.
I think 2018 was one of the strangest years we had. Actually, I remember when we decided to buy the bike, we had talked about it for a long time. It was ultimately my decision since I was the one paying for it, but I just wanted my whole team to be down with it and everybody was on the same page. And we just said like, yeah, we want to buy it. So we talked to Nem and he said, yeah, put a down payment on the bike. I put a down payment on the bike on the Friday of our race in Norway. We had a race that weekend. So I texted him, the down payment is done. And he said, you got yourself a bike.
Nice.
The day after, my boyfriend crashes his bike going almost 200 miles per hour straight into a concrete wall.
Holy.
He ended up being quite bad. He was very lucky. The crash was just horrible. I stood behind him watching it, and everybody was on the start line. They just said, like, there's no way he survived that. and I couldn't get down there. They wouldn't let me.
No, of course not.
I just kept asking, can you at least tell me if he lives? And it took, I think, 20 minutes before they could confirm that he was alive, because they just said, we can't confirm that yet.
The 20 minutes of not knowing whether he was alive or not, how was that for you?
Yeah, it felt like 4 hours or something. It was just, I still, you know, just can remember sitting there like, but just please just let me know. And they just said, we can't let you know. We can't confirm anything yet. And I just wanted them to let me go down there. I know, I remember I was running down there, and they just came there and like
grabbed
picked
you.
Me up.
Yeah.
Yes, they just picked me up and just threw me like over the shoulder and went away. And I remember one guy from my class came there and like hold me and said like, yeah, this stuff happens, you have to like calm down, get your helmet off. And he was just like holding me, I was crying, and it was just horrible. But he was very lucky. He ended up just breaking his hip, and he broke his thigh bone in two places.
Oh wow.
They airlifted him to a hospital nearby, and it was actually a trauma hospital that just dealt with those kind of stuff, so they were excellent. They did surgery the same night, and everything was just, they said it was 100% surgery. Everything was as good as it could get. So he was very lucky. And but yeah, it was like, you know, you went from being on top of the world. Like, I bought my dream bike, and then the day after we crashed one of our bikes, and Kim ended up being in kind of bad shape. And I remember I was sitting in the hotel room with my mom that night, and I just said, like, I think I need to go back and run tomorrow, because I don't think that this is good, you know, psychologically to see something like this.
Yeah.
And then wait, because, you know, it was like 5 weeks for the next race for us. So I remember I called the girl that was in charge of the race, Lynn, and I just asked her, like, I'm leaving a walkover, I'm not racing tomorrow, but could I please come and run out of competition just one pass to see how it feels? And she said, yeah, of course, you can run whenever you want, as many passes as you need.
That's nice.
And they were really great. The whole crew there, they were texting us and asking how he was and everything. It was great. So
that's a family,
I
right?
Remember I went to the, yeah, exactly. That's kind of like the racing spirit and everything. I remember me and my family and the team, we just went straight to the hospital. So the other guys, it was, I think it was raining and, you know, bad weather that night. So they had packed our bikes and everything up into their trailers to keep everything safe during the night and everything. Yep. It just showed how everybody just helps out and everything.
That's awesome.
So yeah, it felt really good. And I came there the day after. I didn't really want to talk to anyone because it was just hard.
Yeah.
But my dad and Arto, our tuner, had set up the bike. And I remember Arto asked me, like, do you want a safe pass or do you want a fast pass? And I said, give it all you got. Just
That's awesome.
Bring everything. Yeah. And we started the bike in the pit. We didn't even, we roll it down and then, you know, you take your helmet on and everything in the lineup. We just drove it down. We drove it straight into, you know, past all the cars, and they just stopped and let us run. And I remember I was really nervous. My dad told me, like, when I was going to stage, does it feel good? And I said, yeah, we just go. And we went and we did a new personal best. We cut like a tenth of our personal best. And then I got a text message from my mother with a picture of Kim watching from the, you know, wake up in the hospital. Yeah. On the live stream, and just showing thumbs up.
So. Good stuff. That's awesome. Yeah.
So that was a strange weekend.
And so have you ever had any crashes yourself?
Yeah, I did. It wasn't a big crash at all. No. Nothing like what Kim had. But actually, that was in Norway. That was our third race of the season.
Okay.
And Then on our fourth race, we went to Sweden. That was a few weeks after. Kim was, you know, with us in the wheelchair on the track. And that was when we rode the 200 miles per hour the first time. So it was this great week. And everything was just, it just felt good to be back. And then I just felt like I really wanted to race more this year, because that was the final race of the year.
Yep.
So we saw that there was this small little race. It wasn't the same crew guys or so. It was another team that kind of, you know, rented the track and was going to do a small event. And since it was the last race of the season, everybody, you know, just went all out.
Yep.
And it was... I don't know how to say it, but it just wasn't the feeling of a regular race, you know, when you know that safety wise and everything, everything is just perfect, like it should be.
Oh, it's a little ragged.
This kind of, yeah, it kind of felt like that.
Yeah.
But we were like, yeah, it's probably fine. But then after one of my passes in the shutdown area, there was something. We don't know if it was oil or if it was just a part or something, but something just happened. I had the GoPro video from behind, and you can just see the bike going straight, and then all of a sudden it just disappears from under me. So the bike just slid off, and I slid off the bike, you know, we're just going on my stomach on the side, and the bike were just going towards the side. So I was all fine. I was... I think I had a few bruises and some scrapes, but nothing more than that. But I remember I was so mad because we had to repair the bike and everything. And it just sucks, some of that. And also, you know, you just want to get back up on it. But I couldn't, because the bike was broken. My leather was broken. The helmet had cuts and scrapes in it. So I couldn't get on it again. And that was, I think, first weekend of September. And the first time I raced after that was actually in US when we were picking up the new bike in December.
That's a big
so
break.
That was also a strange feeling, like new bike, new track,
haven't
raced since I crashed, new helmet, leathers, everything. So we actually did have a good 2020. It wasn't that many events, but we set some records, we did new personal bests, the bike were running just awesome. We did a transition to a new Sonarotor turbo. We have been running another turbo before, but we have been dealing with Tile and Sonarotor for a while, but we haven't really made a step to change to a Sonarotor since no one else is running it on a drag bike. But we actually saw their stuff at SEMA when we met them in 2019, and those pieces are just excellent. So we just said, like, okay, no one is doing it, but that doesn't have to mean it's not working. Like,
that's
we
right,
believe in this, so we tried it. And that has been one of the most fun stuff for 2020, that we actually got to go to a track and try it out and just prove that this stuff works.
COVID impacted the number of events, and probably, like, are you guys allowed to have fans or is it just strictly pit crew only?
Well, for the first events in 2020, we didn't have any spectators at all.
Okay.
For the last event, we did have some. Then they had some spectators, but the pit weren't open, like it always is in drag racing.
Yep.
You know, this part of the charm. So, but actually for the last event, we did have an open pit. It wasn't that many spectators because they couldn't sell that many tickets.
Yeah.
But at least we kind of got that feeling, you know, when you had a good pass and people are waiting for you in the pit and, you know, just want to take a selfie or congratulate you or something. It just raises your spirit. It just feels great when people just come up and wants to talk to you like that. I think it's awesome.
Of all the races you've had, what venue was probably the most spectacular venue?
Well, I have two tracks. I would say, like, for the best track for, like, putting down fast times, I would definitely say the one in Valdosta, the South Georgia Motorsport Park, where I raced. The track is wide, you have a long shutdown area, and everything just feels really safe and good. But here in Euro, if you come here, you have to go to Hockenheim, because that event is so spectacular. I would say the track itself is not one of the best, like, it's not the best to put down the fastest time, and it's kind of bumpy, and it's kind of strange because it kind of goes like, it's like a hill and then it goes down. So when you're standing on the starting line, you can't actually see the finish line.
Oh, wow.
And if you are the crew guy standing on the finish line, you can't see the bike going across the finish line. Oh. So that's very strange. And also, since it's going a little bit uphill, you have to like be careful not to go into stage and then let the bike go, because you can actually roll out. So it's a little bit strange and stuff like that. But you kind of just forget all about it when you're there, because the atmosphere is just fantastic. It's like 60,000 people on the grandstands. And, yep, you know, it's the same track as they do the Formula One races at. So yep, if you've seen it, you have spectators like all the way around. And the commentary guys are like just cheering everyone up, and everyone is just, the spirit is just amazing. And I remember, you know, I raced here in Finland and Sweden, and I had raced once in Santa Pod in England, which is also a great track. And, you know, people were friendly. People came up to talk to you and everything like that. But it was not the same as it was in Hockenheim. When we were just, you know, warming up the bike in the pits, we had 150, 200 people standing around our pit just watching when we warmed up the bike. And when we turned it off, they applauded. And we had a line. Every time we came there, we had a line of people wanting to get a selfie, wanting to get, you know, a hero card sign, wanting to buy a shirt or anything. It was, I've never felt like a celebrity before, but, you know, now I understand how they feel.
Yeah.
That was something special, like something out of what I'm used to.
That sounds like the best crowd to
face. Oh, yeah. Like, if you want to get, you know, cheered up and, like, really see what it's like, come there, because that's a very cool place to race at.
That's awesome. Racing's not inexpensive by any measure. You talk about replacing a helmet, replacing leathers. That's like $3,000 right there. And then fixing a bike. How do you afford all this stuff? Like, you have sponsorship, I imagine, but there has to be some hard work on your end.
Yeah, it's both. I have a full-time job.
Yeah.
So that can't fund it all, but of course a big part of my salary goes into my racing.
Yeah.
And then I also have had some great partners throughout the years. We have had some companies that has believed in us from the start and just, you know, made it possible. We're not, you know, 100% sponsored like some teams are fortunate to be.
Yeah.
We do have to put a lot of our own money in it. And then also I'm very fortunate because we do most of the stuff in-house. My boyfriend builds our engines.
Yep.
We have some of the best engines because we have run fast times. We are very fortunate, haven't had a big engine failure. Mm-hmm. And he's just really, really good at that. And yeah, you know, I don't really pay him any salary. So
yeah.
I saved some bucks there. I've been very fortunate for him to do that for me.
He works for sandwiches, right?
Yeah. And you know, when we both raced, when we had two bikes in the same team, we shared, we split all the work. He did the engines and I worked on what I was good at, you know, just getting sponsorships, keeping them happy, working on the marketing deal and everything. So I did what I could and then he did what he could.
Yeah.
And then we split all the money that came in. And on the races, we had to both work on the bikes. I did the clutches for both bikes. We do them after every run. And he kept the engines, like looked over everything there. We just had to have it like that because there was no way one guy could do everything when you had two bikes in one class.
Yeah, fair enough. Does he race anymore or has he stopped? Or
no, he stopped after his crash.
Yeah.
He did build a new bike, not for the same class. It's kind of expensive to build for a class like this. And since there's no insurances, you know, the bike,
that's it, that's all.
If you crash, you crash. Yeah, that's it. Like, so he built a street legal bike to race in a lower class.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really cool bike, small turbo, like really yeah, he was really cool. We rode it on the streets also. But the thing is, he's not 100% back with his hip. So okay. He got quite a lot of pain. Like every time he rode, he kind of almost had to be home from work the days after because he was in so much pain. And that doesn't really work in the long run. So he sold it. Yeah. And now he bought a jet ski and a dirt bike instead. There you can at least control and, you know, you can race it when you,
yeah,
when you're in good shape and when you feel like it, and then you can stop when you want to. So it's a bit easier.
Being a woman in motorsports, is there a lot of fanfare because of that? Like, do you find that you have people coming by to visit your pit because you're the girl on the track, or?
Yeah, both. I would say I do have people coming by and feeling that it's women that feel it's fun for other women to be in racing. I often have women coming up to me and saying like, oh, my husband loves this, but I haven't really been that involved. But then I saw you and now I can share on you because you're a woman. And yeah. I think that's fun.
It is.
But then also I think we have been good at marketing. I think we put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah.
So I also think that it's not just about the aspect of being a woman. It's also that we how do you say, many people may know what we have been doing when we get there. They have maybe been following us. They know what parts we put on the bike, what yeah. is new and everything. So that also makes it fun for them to follow us and come by and see us when we come to the races. So I definitely think that helps.
Yeah, your social media is pretty exciting. Like, I love when they when they upload videos of you racing and just like from the line, here you are, that big bike with the big back tire, and then just a little dot. It's just like, yeah, so fast.
Yeah, I also like to see those videos. Also,
no doubt.
I do have those, you know, onboard videos.
Yep.
Those are great, but I really loved seeing those where you actually can see the crew also.
Yeah.
Like when you see the crew, and we do when we run the, you know, 688, and you can just see the crew going crazy. Yeah. That's just, I love those videos the most. It makes me so happy.
Oh man, it's like a landlocked rocket ship. Like 688 for a quarter mile. That's so fast. So fast. Like,
yeah, without wheelie bars. I think for me, the reason I fell in love with this class is because I would say I haven't been that into bikes when I was younger,
okay. But
I've always loved racing. I didn't grow up bike racing. We were racing cars. My dad raced pro stock car. And I always loved the pro mods also. They are, you know, they're wild, they're big, they're loud, everything can happen. And that's kind of what super street bikes are in the bike scene. They're wild. You don't know what's going to happen. They are definitely, they're loud. They are unpredictable. I just feel like watching bikes, that was the most fun class for me to watch. It has the high wheel stance, it's action-packed and tight racing, and yeah, I just love that.
When you're on the line just before you launch, what are your last thoughts before go time? Like, does your mind get all calm, or does it get all full of anxiety and crazy thoughts, or?
No, I often get that question, and I always have trouble answering it because I always feel like, what do I think about when I'm standing there? And I can't remember. So it has to be very calm. I just feel like I'm so, usually I can think about stuff.
Yeah.
Up until the point where I roll into the water box, we turn the bike on and they show me it's time to do the burnout.
Yeah.
As soon as I start doing the burnout, I just don't have anything. You're just so focused on the task ahead and you just do everything. I know when we came back, you know, after the, now during the Corona season, like last season, I hadn't been on a bike in, I think it was 9 months.
Oh, wow. And that's a long break.
I just remember, you know, when we went to that event, I was just sitting in the bus on the way up and I was like, man, am I going to remember what to do?
Yeah.
Do I even know? How did I do a burnout? What if I forget something? But then as soon as we started the bike and they showed me, you know, just do a burnout, I didn't even think, everything just
comes together.
You just do everything as you, it just comes naturally. Absolutely.
And your clutch, do you have like a hydraulic clutch or like an auto clutch? Like, how do you get through the gears? Do you got to shift yourself?
Yeah, I shift myself. That's actually one of the things that we have to have in Super Street Bike. The rider have to shift themselves.
Okay.
But I don't shift, you know, with my foot. I shift with a, I have a, air solenoid, you know, and then I shift with a button. So I shift on the horn button.
Okay, that's sweet. And and you basically just bam, 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 bam as you're like screaming down.
Yeah.
And then on
just trying to get the shift points.
And when the boost comes on for the turbo, that's got to be exciting. Yeah. That's got to be like the best feeling ever.
Yeah.
And
yeah, the thing is, we have like, I think I've had a 120, 160 foot.
Yeah.
And that's, if you compare it to US, it's not as fast, but they have, their tracks are different. They can put down more power in the beginning. We really can't. But in Europe, it's one of the fastest 60 foot in this class. But for me, the 60 foot isn't what feels fast.
Okay.
It's what happens like between 100 meters and like 300 meters, because that's where it kicks in.
Yeah.
You know, you can't apply too much boost in the beginning when you don't have any wheelie bars and you don't have a slick tire to rely on. You only have a street tire because you will flip. So you apply as much as you can with low wheelie. And then when you get out there and the boost comes on, then you feel it. And also, you know, your front wheel doesn't really touch the ground
ever
during that part. So you can just feel, the bike being, it just like, it touches and comes up and it touches and comes up, but it's mostly in the air. So you just feel it being loose. You can feel like in the handlebars that it's
the
loose.
Float.
That's where it's most exciting. And then also, of course, with the turbo, it never stops. That's the best part. Like if you're running a naturally aspirated bike, you can feel the power coming in, like, or you can feel the power of the bike, but then after a certain point, nothing more happens. Like you will accelerate a bit, but not that much.
Yeah.
But with the turbo, like it never stops accelerating. It just pushes on and on and on and on.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's like the sweet stuff with it.
And so then it's pure courage after a while, hey? Like, because...
you just hang on.
Yeah. More gas, more speed, and you're just full throttle. Like, with the front end floating and the turbo just winding out and nothing but power on tap, you just trust your mechanic from then on, hey? Because are you more of a passenger or are you a pilot?
I would say, like, when we got the bike over here, when we rebuilt it for 2019 season, I remember I hadn't got my custom leathers yet. So I had to use like a road racing suit that was, I'm quite tall. So it was kind of too small for me. It's too short.
Okay.
So I had a big issue with getting my feet up on the pegs of the bike. So the first run out, like first run ever on the new built bike, they said like run 60 foot, maybe half track if it feels good. And I said, okay, I will hang on as long as it feels good. And I could just feel instantly like, okay, we're on to a killer pass. I have to keep this on. But I couldn't get my feet on the pegs. So I did, you know, like a Superman. I was just like straight, just holding the handlebars. And then I was just like the Superman hanging after it. And we did get a big personal best. We ran a 728 and we had been a 736. So for us, it was great for a first run out. But it just, then I would say I feel I was a passenger there. And it felt like I was doing, you know, 300 miles per hour, because it felt like it was going so freaking fast because I didn't have my feet on the pegs. But after that, as soon as I could get a proper suit again and I could get my feet back on the peg, after that, I feel like I'm the one in charge.
Nice. Yeah, flag on a stick. Like, jeez.
Yeah, that's exactly how it felt like. I think I have a video of it on my Instagram, because I was also, you know, you have that little seat. That you can jump up on the back seat.
Yeah, the hump.
But we don't do it. At least I've never done it. Yeah, but, you know, I was up there and it wasn't by my choice. It was just gravity pulling me there. So I was like straight up the bike.
That must have been crazy. So have you got like a speed in mind, like a top speed that you want to achieve?
We didn't say we had to go 215, but we said we wanted to go faster than Nikki Sack. Nikki Sack runs Pro Nitrous, and she has had the top speed in the world for women on a drag bike, no matter what class. She has been the fastest. And if we could beat her, we would be the top speed holder of women in all drag racing bike classes. And we did this year. So that was for us, that was big. I know we don't count those records. You know, a woman being the fastest isn't a real record. But for us, it was still, it's still like a milestone for me. It feels like, okay, no woman has ever been that fast on a bike. Of course, I want to be fastest, period. Not just fastest as a woman, but just just fastest, period. But it's still something to be happy about, I feel like. Records are meant to be broken. You know,
yes,
someone's going to take it from me one day. Yeah. But it's still nice to have done it. And that was also, you know, when we did the first 200 mile per hour run on a street tire by a woman. That's also something, it's going to be broken, but it was the first.
Yep.
You can never be,
you can't be the first twice. Again. Yeah.
So that was something that was, I know we got some attention from that. And that was the same thing we said. I know it's not an official record, but it's still something that feels good for us because no one has done it before.
Anybody
and
who
it feels good for us to show that you can do.
Yeah. Anybody who rides a motorcycle can appreciate that kind of best. Doesn't matter if it's an official record or not, like 215 miles an hour
to exactly
200 miles an hour. Like, it's a pretty elite group. There's not a lot of people on the planet who've been there. Getting over 210, that's pretty insane. And then every mile above that is pretty insane. You could put two people on the same bike and maybe never have anybody get there again. It takes courage, takes talent, and a good mechanic.
Oh. Yeah, yeah, of course, and a good tuner.
Yeah, have, like everything has to be,
so I'm happy.
The barometric pressure, like there's so many factors that play for or against.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and yeah, to have all the stars align on a street tire, like that part is like insane.
Yeah, and I feel also we were happy because we did it several times because it feels good to do it once, but when you can back it up and do it several times, that was make it feel even better. And it was the same, you know, we won the 2019 series. That was awesome. It was felt really good. But then also we ran the first six in Finland, felt very good. And it was the first six on a street bike by a woman. But then when we run the 689 and 688 and back those up, that's, you know, to back it up felt even better. When we ran the 689, we were the second team to ever do it in Europe.
Yeah.
There is only one guy that's been in the 6.8 before over here. So that felt huge because for me, it wasn't just I'm fast as a woman that some people said. I was like, I'm fast, period. Like, look at us. We are a fast team. We were the second fastest in Europe. Then actually my arch nemesis Vesa came and took it from us, but the second fastest and then we backed it up also, which just made it feel like we know what we're doing, we belong here. I quite often think about something that one of our friends said when we were racing in US. We were actually two Scandinavians racing in US at the same time. The other guy was named Patrick Borg. He was also racing the Pro Street Bike class. And I remember when I was going to run, he came to our hotel room like the night before and we were just sitting there talking. And I was like, this feels so strange. Like, these are the best in the, like, best in the business and I'm going to race against them. What if I don't have what it takes? Or like, what if I can't run this bike? I haven't ever been on this bike before.
That's fair.
And he just said, like, if they can do it, we can do it. What, like, what's the difference? Like, it was just, it just felt so simple when he said it. Like, if they can, we can. Like, it's not an issue. And I just keep coming back to that quite often. Like, when if I ever start to doubt myself a bit, like, Can I run in these conditions? Can I actually handle this if we're doing something new or so? I just see someone else do it and I'm like, if they can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And it's not, it doesn't have to be like, if that girl can do it, I can do it.
No,
I don't
no.
really feel like that. It's just like, if he can do it, I can do it. It's
yeah.
what does he have that I don't have that makes me not being able to do it? Like, it's nothing. It's just, he sits on it and he does it. So I'm going to sit on it and I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Well, you have experience. Like, so, I mean, I could understand in your first week that not ringing true, if they can do it, I can do it. Or, you know, but now.
Yeah. You kind of usually have to
have a little experience.
Maybe
but,
feel like, yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
But at least then you can feel like if they could learn it, I can learn it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If they can do it, eventually I can. Like, they're what makes them so special? Well, I know what does. Like, courage makes drag bike riders special.
I think you need like that, a bit of stubbornness, maybe.
Yeah.
And they said like lacking some brain cells help also.
Maybe. I don't know. Like the not caring about if you're around tomorrow. it's just like getting off the line on a regular sport bike. You know, just trying not to get your wheel too high when you're giving it all you can get. That's nothing compared to the struggle you're going through for the same thing. It's just like your bike wants nothing more than to flip back, like, you know, and you're trying to not do that while getting as close to that moment of release as you can. Like, you know, just
exactly. It's just like finding that
hover
point of, you know,
balance.
What's the max you can do exactly before it just goes goes too far.
And you need to find
it. We have had our fair and share of wheelies also.
Oh, I bet.
First year of racing in Super Street Bike, I did nothing but wheelies. It was just wheelies all the time, and they were not low. They were I've had some that were like, you know, on the verge
12 o'clock.
Of tipping over. I have some pictures like on my Instagram if someone is doubting us, but
yeah.
So we've been there.
Yeah.
But that's also something like with racing and or what whatever you do, me and my team, we've had this theory like we don't want it easy. Like we want to learn the right way.
Yeah.
I know that some teams, when they have new riders, especially if someone is very young, or maybe if it's been a woman that hasn't been that much on a bike and she doesn't really have the confidence to do it, someone else breaks it in for her. Like, okay, now the tune-up is fine.
It's perfect,
I have run this in off before my son gets it or something like that. So the bike is good. I have checked it out. There's no gremlins. I took the bike with all the gremlins. It had so many gremlins, which it took us 2 years to, you know, just
to work them
sort
out.
Them out.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I would have never been ready for the new bike if we wouldn't have done it like that, because I had to learn how to control wheelies coming up fast in the beginning. I had to control wheelies down track. I've had wheelies, you know, 300 meters out. I've had like real bad spin outs, like spinning from the line, like,
just crazy.
Not a little, like a lot. And I've even had, we were on a really bad track, like it was no traction.
Okay.
And something happened to the two steps. So it didn't leave on the RPM we set it in. It left like 11,000. And instead of flipping, it went sideways because there were no traction. So I hit the tree with my foot from the inside of the tree, like going.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Like between the starter and the tree.
Yeah.
And I just saw, the thing is, you know, when you're running turbo, when you get it to spool, you have to go down to 0% to get it to stop spooling. This was my first pass ever on the bike, ever. And I took, you know, a good grip, put it on like full throttle, and then it just went sideways instantly. And I sat up and got off the throttle to be able to, you know, control it. But I had, I think, 7% throttle left, so it kept, you know, spooling a little. So it kept going, and I just had to try and steer it away from the tree because, you know, you don't want to be the girl that hit the tree her first pass.
Yeah, by the tree, you mean the
inside, and just gave it a little slap with my foot.
The light tree, because I guess not everybody listening would know.
Yeah.
Some people are going to think it's like a forest
the
tree.
Racing Christmas tree.
Yeah. The one that has all your attention.
So the thing was, that was my first pass, and then my second pass was a huge wheel stand. So just like the first year of racing, we had a lot of gremlins to sort out.
That's
and
awesome.
Of course, it was also me having to learn how to ride, but it was a lot with the bike also, getting everything to, you know, everything to work. People said often to me, like, someday you will learn with the clutch and the and the gas to not do those high wheelies. And I was like, we run a lockup clutch. I dump the clutch. If I dump the clutch, I can't control it then with my hand. Like, okay. I can let go and I can get it down. But the thing is, when we leave the line, we have the RPM set up on the two step, and then I dump the clutch.
Okay.
And the bike shouldn't wheelie like that.
Okay.
So that's not a rider error. That's just
mechanical.
Something we have. Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, working with the like the chassis of the bike. It was a lot of chassis and a lot of suspension issues had to be sorted out. And like we talked about before, with the short season, it's really hard to knowing which end you're going to start in. Yeah. You change one thing and it gets a little better, but it's still not good. So you have to change another thing. And yeah. But I still feel like that was really good for me because I definitely had to learn the hard way.
Yeah.
But it's no other way to be a good rider fast.
Yeah.
Well, because you have to be able to. It's not just anyone can go fast when it's a good run.
Yeah.
The thing is just that not all run is going to be good runs. You're going to have more bad runs than you're going to have good runs.
Yeah.
And if you can't be able to control them, for once it can be dangerous. But also when you're in competition, you have to be able to save a bad run to be able to stay in competition to have a chance. So
to recover and win.
So I feel like it taught me a lot that I definitely feel useful right now, and it also gives me like the confidence that I know what to do if something happens.
Yeah.
And I think that makes me a better rider when I feel confident on the bike and I feel like throw it at me, I can handle it. I don't have to be scared when running.
Yeah, having a variety of different launches gives you a whole tool bag to deal with what's coming.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like in drag racing, it's rarely just perfect passes all the time. So you have to, you know, have those bad runs also to be able to learn.
I don't know. We get more education from when things went wrong than we ever do from when everything went right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like my dirt biking career is all mistakes. It's awesome.
Kind of how my dirt bike career looks also.
Yeah,
I'm even competed.
I crash a lot. Like, I should be a tester for safety equipment.
But yeah, last time I rode a dirt bike was actually Christmas time this year.
Oh, yeah.
I got to borrow a dirt bike from a friend in Sweden, and we went out to this like sand track here, local sand track. And it's, how do you say, like, it's so soft, the sand. So you have to be like flat out all the way around to
sink.
Be able to save it. Yeah. I could not be flat out. It hadn't been too long for me to be on a bike. So I was just laying down, like all over the place, like falling down every time I got off the gas a little bit. It was too little, and then I just tipped over. And
that's awesome.
I was so mad.
Well, it's like,
it was good exercise.
Yeah, that's what it is. Like, I have a friend, they go on their ride in the sand, and they say it's just exhausting. Like, we don't have much. I live in the Rockies, so we have one little patch where we go where there's some sand. It's just not very big, so I haven't really experienced being able to be wide open on a sand patch, but I have ridden through little bits, and it sucks you down, and it's pretty exhausting.
Yeah. It's just like you're losing control, and sometimes it feels like you have to be flat out, but you're still like just afraid of the bike. Yeah, you know, you're taking control over it. I have a tattoo that says like, when you're in doubt, throttle out.
Yeah.
I do believe in that. It usually fixes everything.
Usually is. When a lot, like on street riding with a lot of guys that crash, it's because they let off the throttle in the turn instead of getting in on it. And they're looking out.
Yeah.
Like, so it's just a combination of problems. But if they had trusted the bike to do its job, they probably would not have crashed. But
Yeah, I had that when I was starting to learn how to ride a dirt bike. I got to borrow a bike from a guy. The issue was, since it was a borrowed bike, I didn't go as fast because I felt like I didn't want to crash.
Yeah.
So I crashed everywhere all the time. And then after a while, I said to him, like, can I buy this bike? And he said, yeah, buy it. So I bought it. And then all of a sudden, I stopped crashing. Yeah. I was like, what happened? But yeah, I picked up momentum because now it's my bike. I can crash my bike. It's not the same as crashing someone else's. And as soon as I got more speed, everything is sorted out. So
that's awesome. So do you think that drag racing is going to take you to another country to live, like someplace that's warmer, longer season?
Oh, that would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've always dreamt of racing in US. The thing is, since this class, it's not... This class isn't available in the US. You can ride Pro Street Bike, but Pro Street Bike, it isn't it isn't as big as the NHRA races or something like that.
Yeah.
So you can't really live of it.
Okay.
You probably could, but I don't feel many people do. It's quite hard. It's not as many races. It's not as much media time. It's not as many guys on the as many spectators or anything like that. So if you want to race in US, I feel like you have to go NHRA racing or maybe some other series that at least is bigger and has more
the money,
media cover, more money, more spectators and everything like that. So if I do go there to race, it probably won't be in Super Street Bike or Pro Street Bike. But I do have some other plans also to maybe go back and racing a little bit more on the car side.
Oh, wow.
So that's something new and exciting that may happen pretty soon. So I'm not abandoning the bike scene.
No.
But I may get my feet wet in one of the car classes in Europe.
Yeah.
And we'll see where that takes us. So.
Yeah, fair. Like, I mean, clearly racing's in your family's blood, not just yours. So, I could see how if you want to make a career, like you're in a boutique class, so to branch out would be the best way. Like, I would love if you could live off of racing and not have to have the day job. Like, I guess that's everybody's dream.
Yeah, you know, that is my dream. And I know I've talked to people about it also. Like, what is your dream? And I always say, like, to work with racing. And it doesn't have to be mainly just work as a racer, but to be involved with industry and, you know, maybe work with the media side of it. And of course I want to race. I don't want to step away as a racer because it's just, it's everything I love and it's what I. It's
and you're successful at it. Life.
Yeah. But I do feel that maybe I have other stuff also to give to the industry. I also, I like to, as we talked about in the beginning, just maybe try to get more women and the younger generation into racing. I like motivational speaking and to just encourage more people to get into the sport. So maybe there's something there also that we could avail all the time.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like all the stuff, like the club that I belong to, we race for the kids, right? Like, so the everybody races on Saturday, Sunday, the kids race. And the president of the club is always saying how, to us adults, like, appreciating the kids and being there for the kids and sticking around for their races is how the sport's going to continue because they're the next generation. I would love to see everybody racing at least once. One time, just go race one time. Like, you know.
Yeah, you see if it's something for you. And also, I feel like also with like the social media being where it is now, it's evolved a lot also over the last like 15, 20 years.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I would also think like before, maybe you have to have rich parents or big sponsors to get into it. But I also feel like nowadays you have another opportunity also to help your partners being visible in social media. It doesn't just have to be, you know, I knew someone and I can get a big logo in the car. And I feel like to teach maybe more people about that. I know it's in US, they've come a long way, but over here in Europe, we are not as good at, you know, at marketing our race teams as they are in US. I would say there are a lot of racers that still kind of maybe, you know, have that feeling that a sponsor should give you something and then you should have a logo on the car or in the trailer and that's pretty much it. But for me, I always try to speak about, you know, you're not a sponsored rider. You know, if I have a partner, a sponsor, I don't usually like talking about sponsors. I like talking about partners. And for a partner, you know, I'm their front person, their face forward. And I have to be, you know, that spokesperson for that. Then I have to be a role model for the kids and other people wanting to get into the business. And I have to use, you know, my social media channels and also my, like my time at the racetrack to just give them the visibility that they need when investing in me. It's kind of, you know, they are hiring me to do a service for them and that's, you know, a marketing service. So I feel like there's a lot to work work on there for a lot of European teams to maybe find that mindset of yeah. what you should give back to your sponsors and partners. And then maybe we could get some more bigger names into the sport in Europe also, because drag racing is a lot smaller in Europe than yeah. it is in USA. But I do feel that maybe we could get more media time, more maybe visibility in television, or maybe get some bigger sponsors to pump it up a little bit. But we do all have to, you know, put in our work and
yeah.
to be a part of this. And I feel that there's also something that would be very interesting to work with.
Well, you seem like a really good ambassador for the sport. Like,
thank you.
I'm in Canada and I'm aware, like, you know what I mean? Like, you've reached your audience is at least this far, you know? And
I feel very like humbled and very, I get very happy when I see like people ordering our shirts or hero cards or something from our website. And then I see I have to ship shirts to Canada, I've shipped yeah. there, and Japan, or I have Greece or Dubai or something. And for me, I'm just, every time I read something like that, how the heck do they know who I am? Like,
yeah.
It feels so strange for me, but that's something that makes me really happy to see. That's also, you know, the social media part of it, because if you were a European racer only racing in Europe, you don't do any media coverage or any social media. Yeah. People won't know who you are
yeah.
when you are in USA or when you are in Canada. And, you know, we have been like so blessed when we have been in US, like going to a race just to watch, and someone has stopped us and be like, oh, I follow you on social media, can I have a picture of you? We had someone like on our hotel in Las Vegas, like, oh, that's you, can I have a picture of you? I get so amazed. No one knows who I am over here. And like, if I go to Sweden, no one would stop me on the street. But so it's just, that kind of shows, you know, what you can do like with social media. You can really be more visible and get, you know, the word spread out there. We have sponsors or partners from US also, and I love to be able to give them that visibility
yeah.
all over. And it's just, for me, it feels like I give back to them what they give to me, and that's yeah. the most important thing. It should be something that both parties get a lot of. I would say, like, we don't have that many sponsors from yeah. the motorsport industry. We have Sona Rotors and Kyle that are great, and we have some small ones, but most of the sponsors that we have, they are not in the motorsport industry. We have, you know, like Cinderella.
Yeah.
A lot of people ask, like, why does it say Cinderella on your back? That's awesome. You know what Cinderella sells?
No,
they sell toilets. They sell, you know, gas toilets that you have like in your RV.
That's awesome.
So you don't ever have to, you know, change one of those like porta potties again. Yep. You have, it's gas. They burn it, and then it's ash, and you just throw it out. It's the best.
Oh, it's okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have it in our race trailer, and actually several teams have installed it in their trailers now. Also, it's just, it's the best thing. I saw it actually. I think they sell in US a little bit now, but it's mostly here in Europe.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that most people don't think is a motorsport sponsor.
Yeah, but you got to take care of the business.
But it doesn't have to be in the motorsport industry. But I just feel like there's so many RVs and trailers
yeah.
In the motorsport industry.
Yeah.
And everybody always complains about having to go empty the damn shit all the
yeah,
time.
The sandy dump.
Who is going to empty it? No one yeah. wants to do it. Yeah. I don't do it. Like, no. And then it's better to, you know, you just invest in this. Nothing is gross anymore. Anyone can do it. You just empty it out in the grass.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Just ashes. So, I mean, there's a big potential there for customers. So that's kind of what you have to see. Like,
yeah.
okay, this isn't a motorsport product, but there's a lot of people in the motorsport industry that would
benefit.
Love this product.
Yeah, you bet.
So
yeah.
Then we can give something back to them.
Their marketing team have geniuses. They're like, who's the big RV company or customer? Yeah, Motorsport. These guys. Yeah, everyone exactly. lives in their trailer.
And they're so. Great guys yeah. also. So I actually sell those things in my day job. That's oh, okay. kind of how I got in touch with them. And we just saw like this would be great for our bus. Yeah. And since they're great guys also, we talked to them and they've been on board with us ever since. And it's just great. And it feels great also to not just all have the same sponsors. Of course, it's good with those, you know, motorsport companies that really invest in motorsports. I love it. Absolutely. But I also love seeing outside companies getting involved with the sport, because that also means that there are many new potential customers that we can attract for those companies. So
it just shows that there's an interest in the sport. Like it's not left off to the side in corporate America or, you know, corporate Europea. I said, like, forget it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of sweet. All right. Well, looks like I've come to an hour here. Do you want to thank any of your do a shout out to all your sponsors and stuff? I can put that as a clip if you'd like.
Yeah, well, of course, I want to give a shout out to my amazing partners and sponsors for them believing in me. We have a lot of them, but, you know, our main partner, Emstrand or Eklundsbygg, with Janne running the threads on that company. He has been with us since the beginning and he has been a big part of us being able to go racing as we had. And that's, I really appreciate that. And then also we have the great partners from Cinderella and Sona Rotors Tile. We have Lux Center that does the paint on our bikes and Mekonom, and that's a local company over here that helps us too. And we have a lot of the smaller ones also that help out, but they're all equally important to me because they all make it work and go together.
Nice.
Those and my team.
Sweet. Well, it was really great talking with you, and I do look forward to talking to you again, and all the best in the future. So, all right.
That's great talking to you too.
Have Hope a good time.
Here soon.
Bye.
Take care.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. I want to thank my guests for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. A special thank you to you, my supporters. Without you, this would not be possible. If you enjoyed the show, give it a 5-star rating. And if you haven't already, be sure to like, subscribe, and share. If this is your first time listening, I encourage you to take the 3-episode challenge. Once again, thank you for your continued support, and stay tuned to find out what's coming up next time.